Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Remember the Axis of Evil? North Korea, Iran, and Iraq were the countries President Bush famously branded with this title. Well, their cuisines are all pretty delicious. Today we'll eat in hopes of forging diplomatic ties. Also, how a town whose lake is polluted with dioxins is using mushrooms to clean it up. And even if you avoid tofu like the plague, you're still likely eating soy every day. But first, let's see what's in season at the farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting with Robin Smith here at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. She's one of the co-owners, along with her husband, Steve, of Mud Creek Ranch, which is a certified organic farm up in Santa Paula. Today, Robin has some quince. And a quince is a fruit. It kind of looks like a fuzzy apple. Aside from that, I think very few people understand it, and very few farmers grow it. So, Robin, could you tell us why you grow it? Can you tell us what variety you have and maybe how you like to cook it?
The quince is actually in the apple family. It's very, very high in pectin. It's an old fruit that they used to add to other fruits for making jams and compotes. It possibly is the apple from the Garden of Eden. Don't know for sure. We cook it like an apple. We bake with them. They're pretty tart when they're raw, though some people like to eat them with lemon. They cook up just like an apple.
So when you say you bake them like an apple, are you talking like you make a quince pie or you do a whole baked quince like a baked apple?
We like them baked apple type. You take out the core, you drizzle on maple syrup or whatever you like, and then put them in the oven for about an hour at 350.
And you tell they're done when they just start to collapse and look all soft.
Yeah.
Can you eat the skin?
Yeah.
So then you take it out of the oven, it's all hot and fabulous. And then what do you put on it to eat it?
Probably maybe once in a while whipped cream. But
now we're talking. Yeah.
It's interesting because when it's raw, the flavor is totally different than when it's cooked.
And I understand also that you can take a quince and just leave it in the house, and now does it give off a nice, pleasant aroma?
It does. Very nice and very unique. Kind of hard to describe it. A little bit tropical.
And you're going to have them for how long?
A week or two is all.
Oh, really? Is that all?
Yeah, you know us. We only plant five trees of this, five trees of that.
All right. And tell us what markets you sell at down here in LA so people can find you.
Hollywood on Sunday.
Okay, and then Wednesday, Santa Monica. That was Robin Smith. She's a certified grower from Santa Paula, California. Her farm is called Mud Creek Ranch. We are now speaking with Nicholas Peter, who is a chef owner of The Little Door and The Little Next Door up in LA. He is one of the premier chefs who shops here every single week at the market. And Nicholas has a wonderful recipe with quince. It's the classic French quince paste. Tell us how you make it and then how you enjoy eating it.
With a quince, you're able to do two things. You're able to do a jelly, and with the mass of the meat of the quince, you're able to do a paste. So basically, first you wash them really good because there's a lot of fuzz on them. So you wash them really good, and first of all, you need to have a really ripe and really a perfumey quince. That you'll know it's ripe.
Is it soft when it's ripe?
No.
You tell by
no.
the smell?
No, it tells, especially by the smell and by the color of it.
So it'll turn from green to a more yellow.
Okay. To yellow. And then, so basically you wash them, you peel them, you boil the skin to extract as much pectin as you can get from them. And then you cook the liquid you have with that, you cook the meat, the flesh. And with that, you're able to get a liquid that you're able to match with an amount of sugar, and you can make jelly with it. And it has enough pectin to really set. Then with the rest of the used or boiled flesh, you process into a puree and use equal amount of sugar and cook it down to dehydrate to the maximum. Your quince will turn ruby in color, and it'll start coming off from the sides. Now watch out, because it reacts like a lava. So the best thing to do is put a lid on it and really stir as much without scorching. Anyway, after a while, being dehydrated and the color that you want, you put it on a sheet pan, a little bit, a grease sheet pan.
How deep
do
you
spread? Oh, maybe an inch.
An inch thick.
Okay. And then you cover it with cheesecloth and let it dry for at least 4 days. And what it does is really create a really thick and hard pastes that you're able to cut to any shape and form you want to do. You can keep it for months outside, you know, if, as long as it's layered. They'll sweat a little bit, but that's not a big deal. A lot of, like in Spain, or they put bay leaf to separate the pieces of quince, so it can add a perfume to it.
Oh, nice.
And then you use it a lot with cheese. Manchego.
Salty cheese.
Salty cheese, because the sugar, the sweetness of it. And it's one of my favorites. Every year I can't wait for quince to come back.
All right, now you're going to be starting to serve this.
Buying it today, so I'm excited. It's first day.
All righty. All right, Nicholas. And tell us where the little door is located.
On the 8164 West 3rd Street.
Now, are you selling this to go? Can people buy it?
Definitely. I will have the jelly probably in a week, and then the paste, and maybe, you know, maybe 2 weeks.
Because
it's got to dry for 5 days.
Right. All right, Nicholas, thank you. I'm so glad that's this time of year. Thanks
so much.
You're
very welcome. Thank you.
It is grape season throughout California. We're talking with one of our original farmers here at the Wednesday Market, Elmer Lehman. He's been in the grape growing business for
a lifetime. Right.
And what have you got here today, Elmer, at the Wednesday Market?
The Thompson grapes and the flame.
Okay, Thompson are the little green seed, the little green seedless. Now yours are round. Flame. You have not jibbed your grapes, right?
No, we didn't jib this year on the regular Thompsons.
Okay, and jib is a term that's used when farmers apply something called gibberellic acid.
Right.
And that makes the grape take up more liquid.
More liquid makes them bigger.
Bigger, but less flavor.
They do have more flavor when they're natural.
All right, and so you've got these wonderful Thompsons. They're green, they're turning amber, and then there's some little baby raisins. Those are super sweet.
A few raisins stuck in there.
That was Elmer Lehman. He is a farmer from Fresno. He's been a raisin farmer, grape farmer all his life, and he's been at the Wednesday Market since we opened in 1981. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you've never seen a quince, you can actually go online and see what Laura Avery was just talking about. Just go to kcrw.com/goodfood. We've long known that mushrooms are powerful. Their smell can inspire animals for miles. And of course, there's certain psychedelic properties. One town is actually using their power in quite another way, to clean up their polluted lake. More on one of nature's most incredible species next, when Good Food continues. Of course, these days we hear a lot about miracle foods. Blueberries and broccoli, we're told, are just about the perfect foods that we can possibly eat. But today we're going to talk about another miracle food. This one, way beyond feeding and healing the body, is also working to heal the environment. It's a mushroom. Paul Stamets is the go-to guy when it comes to fungi. He's got a website called Fungi Perfecti, and he's working to remediate an environmental dioxin contamination using mushrooms. Could you tell us about the situation up in Fort Bragg, California?
Okay, well, Fort Bragg is a mill town. Georgia Pacific has had a mill there for a very long time, several decades. And not intentionally, but inadvertently, the town has been dusted with dioxin-laden soot, basically. Dioxins are extremely toxic. And they're recalcitrant, which means that they stay in the ecosystem for a very long time. And the mill site up there, because they had all this ash, they promoted it as a soil amendment. So it was spread into the surrounding community, unfortunately onto the public school soccer fields and into people's gardens, et cetera. And later, the town and the residents therein discovered that soil amendment was laden with this potent carcinogen. There's a legal burden now attached to the property because the dioxins need to be managed or cleaned up. And there's only a few alternatives. You can cap it, but the dioxins do make it into the water table. It could be dug up and transferred to an incineration site. And the more practical approach is using mushroom mycelium to do in situ remediation, what we call micro-remediation. By a quirk of nature, or through natural selection, over hundreds of millions of years, these fungal mats have developed exquisite digestive juices that can break down complicated heavy mass molecules into simpler forms.
Now, are there any projects which have been done thus far for bioremediation, for cleaning up toxic spills?
Yes, there's several that we've been involved in, most notably a site near Bellingham, Washington, where the soil is saturated with bunker C oil and diesel. And we used oyster mushroom mycelium and broke down that diesel in about 8 weeks.
So it's the nature of the complexity of these mycelia to sort of delink these heavy molecules, and it seems to happen incredibly quickly. How difficult is it to do? Do you start with the small little mat that's already been pre-prepared, and then you introduce it to the environment, and it just takes off because it starts eating?
Fungal mats are hungry. They're constantly looking for new sources of nutrition. And as they starve out and get hungrier, they develop eloquent alternative systems of being able to forage for novel nutrients. And so toxic wastes actually become food for the fungal mycelium.
I'm in my mind imagining, you know, a part of a coastline or a bay that's been in terrible shape into which these mycelium have been introduced. And then you see all these beds of oyster mushrooms everywhere. Are they then edible?
Excellent question. And in terms of what we did with Battelle, when we analyzed the mushrooms for hydrocarbon residues, there was none found. However, unfortunately, with a toxic waste site, there oftentimes is a plurality of toxins, more than one. So if it was just on a diesel spill, you know, I personally would feel safe enough to consume it. But if you use crankcase oil from the bottom of your car, for instance, there could be metal shavings in that. And mushrooms do hyperaccumulate certain metals. And so that's an advantage, perhaps, in bioremediation of heavy metal-contaminated environments, but not an advantage for you as a consumer to eat those mushrooms grown on that habitat. We have to be very careful in recommending that anyone eat mushrooms from along even roadsides. You shouldn't do that.
So at what point are you now in terms of really getting your teeth into a really large project?
Well, we have about five different locations concurrently. There's a Fisherville site back on the East Coast. The EPA has approved many hundreds of thousands of dollars to remediate. I am actively involved in several microfiltration sites here in Mason County. We live in the southern Puget Sound where there's shellfish and oyster beds. We've installed what we call mycopods. These are burlap sacks full of oyster mushroom mycelium that do two things. They catch the runoff from storms that carry petroleum products, you know, oil, dioxins, etc., into the waterways, into the shellfish beds, and harm the salmon runs. And so we have great success in reducing coliform bacteria and petroleum products from entering into the sensitive ecosystems. So we have a two-for-one. We filter bacteria that are harmful as well as getting rid of toxic waste. And we're advocating this as a best management practice. And I often say that it wasn't our parents' intention to create carcinogens throughout the ecosystem. They didn't want to harm downstream generations. But back then, it was better living through chemistry. And we have these inadvertent effects. And they'll take one generation to pollute and maybe 10 generations to fully clean up the ecosystem that has been polluted.
My guest, Paul Stamets, is a mycologist who has discovered four new species of mushrooms. He's well known for his classes and books on how mushrooms can change the world. Read an article on the Fort Bragg cleanup at kcrw.com/goodfood. There's another food product which has taken over the world quite literally. It's soy. Byproducts of this bean are eaten every day, even by you, whether or not you know it. In fact, soy's come to be the poster child for the industrialized and processed food system. I'll tell you more next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. really know about soy, that it's a wonderful source of vegetable protein? Well, soy is a lot more stealthy than that. It's in nearly every processed food. And what I want to know is, how did this stinky bean come to dominate the food chain, and what are the consequences of this dominance? Raj Patel is the author of Stuffed and Starved, which is a look at the complex historical factors which are causes of the current food crisis. Let's talk for a minute about soy. So many of us think of it as this wonderful miracle food, but it has this whole other side. It's sort of like the poster child for the industrialized food chain.
Well, that's right. And in many ways, it is a miracle food. I mean, this is why I spend a little time talking about it in Stuffed and Starved, because it's an example of how something completely amazing can get turned into something stealthily quite dangerous. As you suggest, it's in the majority of processed food. It's the most widely consumed vegetable oil in the United States. And yet most of us don't really realize that we're eating it. So let's talk about how soy entered the Western diet. Because for the longest time, Europeans didn't really understand that the bean that they saw growing on a bush was related to to tofu and to soy sauce and all the rest of it. And in fact, soy is named after, not after the bean, but after the Japanese word for soy sauce, shoyu. So in other words, soy is named after not the original plant, but its processed product. And that's really the key to understanding soy and its place in our world today. Soy needs processing. If we're to eat it in any way at all, it needs to be processed. If we're going to access these wonderful proteins inside it, it needs some sort of intervention. Because if you eat raw soybeans, you'll get nothing but flatulence.
Tell me a little bit about that processing. Give us an idea of what is done to the bean to create some of the products that are used in our food supply.
Well, there's a big difference between the traditional methods of processing, which involve fermenting the bean or gently cooking it over a day and then sort of soaking it and cooking it and then pressing it by hand. Those are very time and labor intensive processes, but they're not the kinds of processes that work well with modern industry. And industrial processing is something rather different. I visited a soy plant in a sort of processing plant in Brazil, and it was a terrifying sort of industrial future made flesh, as it were. I mean, you start off in these huge warehouses there, where there are tons upon tons of soybeans gently collapsing on top of one another like sort of rattlesnakes, and people have been killed just by sort of soy landslides, as it were. But from there, the soy is crushed and it's turned into these little flakes, and then it is passed through an industrial solvent called hexane, which is sort of lethal, but it's a great solvent. It sort of takes out some of the sort of oils and the proteins, and then the soy is either sort of ground to dust, or it's sold as the flakes, or it's used in producing things that appear in other places like vegetable oil or lecithin, which is an emulsifier that's in most chocolate and ice cream and what have you. From the bean stage, it goes through a range of heavily mechanized industrial processes that are very different from the original ways in which soy was processed. And it's in that shift from a traditional mechanism for processing soy into this industrial way of processing soy that I think some of the problems are starting to crop up.
So let's talk about it as a crop, because the uniqueness of its nitrogen-fixing ability in the soil is what sort of gave it its first inroad into really large plantings in the United States, isn't it?
That's right. It was was used as a crop to replenish the soil that had been blown away by the Dust Bowl years. And it was specifically targeted as part of the New Deal as a crop that would receive federal support. And that meant that it was integral to rebuilding some of the soil in the Midwest. The trouble is that it was planted as part of a monoculture. And when you have a monoculture of anything, that already means that you're displacing a vibrant ecosystem in which soy is an important part, and you're wiping that out and just growing one thing and destroying everything else, destroying the ecosystems that would naturally surround a plant like soy. Brazil is the largest exporter of soy, and in Brazil, soy plantations are responsible for deforesting the Amazon, for example. And it's not just environmental damage that's being caused by the industrial monoculture of soy. It's also it's labor damages as well. I mean, in Brazil today, the International Labor Organization estimates anywhere up to 40,000 slaves working on biofuels plantations in Brazil, but also on soy plantations.
You know, sometimes I wonder if, you know, there's all of these unexplained rises in allergies and strange immune system disorders. And one wonders if anybody at all is looking at products like soy, which have found their way into our food system in such a ubiquitous manner.
It's not necessarily the crop that's bad. I mean, bear in mind, soy has been cultivated and eaten in China and Southeast Asia and around the world for centuries. And people are not, you know, these diseases that we're seeing of associated possibly with food haven't really been cropping up in Asia. But that's because this gets us back to this sort of processing idea, that the way soy has been processed in Asia is that those processing techniques evolved over decades, over centuries, whereas the kinds of processing that we have now are barely 50 years old. And there are increasing concerns about the way modern processed soy affects hormone balance, for example. And soy is a reasonable place to look at it, particularly since the way we process it now has so little to do with a natural or well-tested approach to processing it. In fact, the way we process food today, and soy is just one example, isn't really about our health, but so much as driving down costs for the food producers.
Raj Patel is the author of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World's Food System. He's currently a researcher at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa and a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at UC Berkeley. Raj and I actually sat down for a really great face-to-face conversation for Book TV on C-SPAN. I'll have a link for you at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's hard to avoid hearing about America's foreign policy. The last number of years have been focused on President Bush's axis of evil. Next, meet a woman who took her extensive knowledge of foreign policy and wrote a cookbook. It's The Cuisines of the Axis of Evil. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. If Jon Stewart were to reveal even more about what he thinks about certain governments in the form of a cookbook, it might be called Cuisine of the Axis of Evil. Well, Chris Fair beat him to it. She's a D.C.-based analyst of South Asian political and military affairs who decided to take a just unbridled, snarky romp through the Axis of Evil through the cuisine. Now, this is such a whacked out and fabulous idea, I must say. But
I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you.
But what made you decide to use your extensive background in political and military analysis in a menu context?
Though it is a funny book in intent, it actually is a somewhat sad book in its origins. My brothers are in the Indiana National Guard. They were called up to go to the Iraq War. They were first in. Mercifully, they were the first out. And I'm someone, I don't eat my way through depression, but I cook my way through depression. So pretty much early on, I began having dinner parties that took on the appellation of the AOE, the Axis of Evil dinner parties. And it became an opportunity to bring people into my house, to cook, to commiserate, to perhaps libate a little bit, and sort of generally grouse about the state of affairs and where things were going.
Okay, let's talk about Iraq and Iran. They're neighbors. A lot of people haven't really clued into how different the cultures are, the difference between Arab and Persian culture. So let's approach it from a cuisine point of view. How is their cuisine different from one another?
Persian food is really quite different from items that you would quintessentially think is Arab. For example, you don't find baba ganoush, you don't find falafel or fattoush in Iran. They do a lot of roasted meats, kebabs. They tend to pile those kebabs upon pillows of rice. And the Iranians have a really interesting speciality. It's called tadig. And tadig literally means the bottom of the pot. So the first time I was served this, I nearly broke a crown. I kid you not. It's absolutely hard as a rock. And it's made by taking the rice kernels and letting them fry to an absolute crust on the bottom of the pot. And they scrape that out. Friends and family who are especially loved are given first shot at eating the tadig. Iranians also are famous for these fabulous stews that use fresh fruit as well as dried fruit. Iraqi food is more of the typical Arab food that you might think of.
Which would be like, if we're talking about not all the beginning sort of grazing stuff, but if we're talking about main food, what would that be?
Well, when it comes to main food, it's quite different in that sense. So, for example, Iraqis have kibbeh. One variety is quite interesting. They actually make it from rice instead of bulgur. Iraqis like okra. I have never seen people like okra so much apart from the American South. Another thing that's quite popular among Iraqis is turkey, birds, poultry. And one of the things, if you go back and you look at some of the earliest scrolls that transcribe human activity going back to the days of Babylon, what you'll find on those scrolls, which are, of course, in modern-day Iraq, are recipes for beer and cooking bird.
Don't you love that?
I do. I absolutely love it. You kind of think of everything that survives everything. It's a recipe for beer.
So let's talk about okra for a minute. Okra is one of those vegetables that has a tremendous love-hate factor. Yes. Because of the slime factor, people either love it or hate it. So describe this slime.
Here's the problem with okra. As soon as you cut that stuff, you get the slime. So the key with making okra is to never cut it. So I learned this trick in Pakistan, of all places. Pakistanis also eat a lot of okra, and I have never had slimy okra in Pakistan. They will tend to use the whole thing. And they also prefer to not wash it. They'll treat it more like a mushroom. So they'll take a wet cloth and they'll hand wipe each and every okra pod. And if you can then get that stuff into some hot oil, it never slimes up.
And now also kibbeh. A lot of people may not know what kibbeh is. Could you describe it?
The guts of the kibbeh is basically ground lamb with onions, typical spices like nutmeg and pine nuts. So it's basically bulgur soaked in water. It's a relatively fine grade of bulgur. And then, of course, appropriately spiced. And then you take that bulgur, the wet bulgur mixture, and you sort of roll it into a golf ball-sized sphere. And then you take your fingers, your thumbs, and you start pressing in an indent and working your way around it until you get what looks to be half of a torpedo. You then take a couple of tablespoons of that meat mixture and you stuff it into your half of a torpedo. You pinch the ends, dip it into about a vat of oil, circa 350 degrees, and fry it up. And it's done when it's nice, crispy, and brown.
Okay, so if we look at the cuisines of the Axis of Evil, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, is there anything that links them?
No, not really. A couple of interesting things, though, to note. North Korea and Iraq, of course, have had extreme bouts of food insecurity. That's not because the places are unable to provide food for their people. It's just that the policies of their governments made it very difficult to do that. North Korea, one of the most ostracized countries in the international community, has had repeated problems with famines. And because their food distribution highly privileges, of course, Kim Jong-ilin, as I like to call him, and his coterie of goons, you have this really horrific situation where average people are foraging in public parks for bark while he he's having a highly renowned Japanese sushi chef serve him up fish that are still breathing as he eats them. You know, of all the countries in the book that I have, in some sense, Iran is the most normal in terms of its relationship with food. I like to say they're sort of, you know, they're like the version of us stuck in the Middle East. They like to have their piles of meat and their carbs, but instead of eating potatoes, of course, they're eating rice.
Cuisines of the Axis of Evil is Chris Fair's cookbook. It's written like a cross between a foreign policy magazine and an international cookbook. Find the recipes we mentioned at kcrw.com/goodfood. Diplomacy doesn't only apply to foreign countries. We utilize it every day when handling sticky situations. Euphemisms are a diplomatic way of handling certain subjects, especially when it comes to food. Think of sweetbreads. There's nothing sweet or bread-like about this dish. What it really is, and the other phrases used to gloss over what you're really about to eat, next. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. When I was younger, I was going to say a little girl, but, you know, kind of small, and just wending my way through the beginnings of food literature, and I heard the word sweetbreads. And of course, in my mind, it was this really beautiful, fluffy, sweet bread that was somehow used in cooking. And then when I found out that it was a thymus gland, I think I felt betrayed. The world of food euphemisms is so interesting, and with me today to explore this subject is Eddie Lin, our friend from Deep End Dining, which is his blog in which he explores his walks on the wild side of food. And I guess a lot of the things you eat probably do have euphemisms.
Yeah, this is one of those times I wish your show was a call-in show, because I would love to hear what people would guess what sweetbreads is if they don't know what it is already. The purpose of a euphemism is to kind of mellow the harshness of an offensive or difficult subject. But food euphemisms, I mean, the reason why I love it so much is because it has kind of a more higher calling or lower calling, if you want to say it that way. Because what it has to do is to kind of almost fool you or trick you into eating it. You know?
Eating something that, if it said bull's testicles, that deep fried,
you'd be like, no way. Right.
But they're called?
Rocky Mountain oysters or cowboy caviar.
Cowboy caviar, like huge, giant caviars. That's so funny.
Yeah. So, you know, it could be funny. It could be, you know, in a foreign language, you know, it could be escargot. You know, it sounds better than snails, you know. Escargot, it sounds exotic. Or it could be named after someone, you know, like carpaccio. You know, of course, we know it as raw beef that's sliced, or actually raw any kind of meat that's sliced very thinly. Well, that's named after someone, you know, so it is? Yeah. Well,
I didn't know that.
According to what I've found out, the person it was named after is a Venetian painter named Vittore Carpaccio. So it could be an urban legend or it could be...
Oh, I have to ask. Wait, now I have to ask.
Well,
we should ask the people at Harry's Bar. Apparently they're the ones who supposedly invented Carpaccio.
That's right. That's the person who named it Carpaccio.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah. So, and then actually Tartars, it kind of has the same story. It's supposedly named after a Central Asian people who were... called the Tartars.
Yeah, the Tartars.
Tartars, yeah. And, you know,
so named after dental plaque.
No, not, I don't know if that would be a euphemism anymore.
What are some other good ones?
Well, I love lamb fries and rooster fries. I mean, that's just so misleading. you know.
And is it called these are, of course, testicles, lamb fries and rooster fries.
Right. You say, of course, but if you were some layperson.
Rooster has fries?
Yeah, rooster. Well, they're internal, but yeah, they have testicles.
How tiny are they?
They're actually pretty respectable, you know, in respect to the size of the rooster. I would say they're about a large malt ball or a large bubble gum, you know.
And are they called fries because they're normally served fried?
Yeah, generally, exactly.
Now, since we've mentioned all kinds of testicles, bulls and roosters and lambs, what is the texture like?
It's spongy. If they don't slice it and fry the heck out of it, it's generally spongy.
Do you like them?
Yeah, generally. You know, there's a little gaminess to some of them, but yeah, generally.
Okay, back to euphemisms. I had to just ask.
Okay. Well, the other one I really like is black pudding. You know, I mean, it sounds scary.
Blood sausage.
Yeah, blood sausage. But, you know, the British...
It looks scary, too.
Yeah, it looks scary. Something even trickier is chocolate pork. And that's a Filipino nickname for basically these coagulated, boiled cubes of pork blood. Chocolate pork. And you know, if you didn't know any better, you would, I don't know, think it was some kind of fondue thing where you have this...
Or molded chocolates in the shape of a little piglet.
Oh, yeah. Even more diabolical. it's such a pack of lies, but it's kind of fun.
But hey, you know, if it gets people intrigued enough to have a little bite and sort of stretch their boundaries when it comes to food, that's nice.
Yeah, it is.
Any more to share with us?
Oh, sure. I mean, Mexican truffles.
Which some people call corn fungus and others call corn smut.
Yes. And that's the reverse of the food euphemism. That's like, you know, I guess the reverse would be, you know, blasphemy, food blasphemy. And you know, it kind of makes sense because in Mexico, this corn fungus is highly prized. And in fact, it costs more than a healthy ear of corn.
Of course.
And over here, they're trying to eradicate it. And it's called corn smut here. And it's called the Mexican truffle over there.
It's all your point of view.
Yes. And that's why I'm here. You know, I'm trying to just explain that one man's corn smut is another's truffle.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Eddie Lynn. When Eddie's not eating rooster fries or other things worthy of being renamed, he's contributing to his blog called Deep End Dining. Find it on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you eat kosher, I'm sure you would have to avoid visiting some of Eddie Lynn's favorite restaurants. If you think about it, the term kosher has come to imply not just the dietary rules of the Jewish faith, but also a sign of food prepared cleanly and ethically, all under the watchful gaze of a rabbi. We all got a big shock a few months ago when an immigration raid at the nation's largest kosher meat processing plant exposed possible unethical treatment of its workers. There's a group trying to do something to ensure that kosher really does mean all that it implies. More on that in 1 minute, right here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Years ago, I interviewed author Stephen Bloom about his book, which chronicled the clash of cultures happening in Postville, a small Iowa town, where a group of Lubavitcher Jews moved to take over a small meat processing plant. The plant subsequently became Agra Processors, the largest kosher processor in the nation. The company's been in the news lately because of serious immigration violations that have some who eat kosher wondering about business behavior that just isn't kosher. With me today is Rabbi Morris J. Allen. He's the project director of Hechsher Tzedek, a movement which is an initiative to link kosher food regulations with labor and environmental standards. We see the brands Aaron's Best and Rubashkin's at Trader Joe's here in Southern California.
Agriprocessors was the largest producer of kosher meat and poultry combined in America, and at some point over the last several years it accounted for perhaps 65 to 70% of the kosher food meat products sold in the country.
Can you tell me what some of the violations were?
The current violations, I think, that have been reported in the newspaper appear to be child labor, forging of documents, or use of, you know, stolen documents in terms of identity theft, issues around health, safety, and training in the plant.
Let's talk about Hechsher Tzedek. I know I was on one of your websites, and there was a really marvelous quote about the blood of an egg.
It's a wonderful quote from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, in which he, over 40 years ago, said that why is it that we are concerned about having a ritual supervisor in a butcher shop, but not in other parts of the community, essentially? And he said, if a drop of blood is found in an egg, which for us as Jews would render it unfit for consumption, we won't eat it. He said, but if a drop of blood is found in, you know, a dollar, meaning, of course, that it's been made at the expense of someone else's exploited labor, we turn a blind eye. That was basically a paraphrase of his quote. The sense is that ethics cannot be divorced from ritual. And for us as Jews, both are necessary.
I've actually been reading a lot about Ramadan lately in the news, and there seems to be also this same introspection of ritual aspects of eating are not the only thing it's about, that it's about taking the intentions that the ritual is supposed to give you and moving it throughout your life.
Well, and I would say that the whole reason the kashrut matters in our daily life is that it's an act of sanctification. It's an opportunity to bring holiness in our lives. And we have always assumed that a kosher product responds to a higher authority, as it were. And in fact, what we have discovered is that that's not the case, that we are, our sense of how sacred our act is by keeping kosher has been tarnished by the realization that sometimes in the production of kosher food, Jewish ethical norms and laws have been violated. And all that Hechsher Tzedek wants to do is to place a secondary seal on those products that are already determined to be ritually fit to demonstrate that they are already ethically fit.
So it's something like what a fair trademark
does. It would be parallel to a fair trademark. That would be right.
For people who don't understand what the word kashrut means or even what keeping kosher means, could you give us a little primer?
Sure. Kashrut or kosher means fit. And in the five books of Moses, in the book Leviticus, there's a whole description of those animals that are fit for human consumption and those animals that are not. So, for example, a four-legged animal would have to chew its cud and have split hooves. Also, Jews do not eat meat and milk products together, so something like a hamburger pizza would be, you know, forbidden on many different levels.
Tell me what the words Hechsher Tzedek mean.
Well, a Hechsher, it has the word kosher in it in the Hebrew, but it would be like a certification of justice.
Thank you so much. A very, very interesting conversation. That was Rabbi Morris J. Allen. He's project director of Hechsher Tzedek. We'll have a link to their website, which is incredibly interesting, at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Hear the interview I did with author Stephen Bloom about the Agri Processors plant in Postville, Iowa. The side story of the impact the plant had on this town is really interesting. Let's take a break from all this serious stuff and go have something to eat. I'll be back with a food find in Orange County. That's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I have to say I'm a little embarrassed because it's been way too long since we've checked in with our OC, Orange County Ambassador, who is, of course, Gustavo Arellano, food editor for the OC Weekly. I'm so happy to see you again.
No, thank you for having me on again.
So what are you going to suggest for us down there in the OC?
The best deal in Orange County, Tacos El Chavito.
Now, it's really funny because you actually were doing an article. I saw something that you were taking a look at foods between free and $5.
It's our annual summer food issue. So it came out in the August 7th issue of the OC Weekly. It was our cover story. We called it Brother, Can You Spare a Taco? And we talked about the best deals in Orange County between $0 and $5, $5 and $10, and $10 and $15. And it encompassed everything from high-end restaurants in Newport Beach to Tacos El Chavito, which is a taco truck in an industrial area of Huntington Beach that sells two tacos for a dollar and gives you free pineapple juice.
How can they afford to do that? I feel like going and giving them an intervention.
No, please don't. Please don't. You're going to rob all of Orange County of the best meal. The way they do it is just they sell so much bulk. You'll have people, just men, you know, coming from construction saying, give me 30 tacos. 30 tacos is going to cost them about $15. And you see that again and again and again. Or you also have people just go up and order, oh, give me six tacos. That costs $3.
That's extraordinary.
And the best part about it, these tacos aren't stereotypical Roach Coach material. These are really good, authentically good tacos that are really as one of the better, I'd say one of the five best tacos in Orange County.
So describe that. Describe, because, you know, there are a lot of people out there who hear us talk about truck tacos, but they still can't get over that bricks and mortar thing. They think that if they walk up to a truck, they're exposing themselves to something wild and crazy.
No, well, all taco trucks, they do have to be regulated here in Orange County by the Board of Supervisors, the health agency. So everything's legit. And a taco truck taco is different from a brick and mortar taco in the sense that the tacos are usually with a smaller tortilla. So in Tacos El Chavito, the tortilla is probably around the size of your palm, and it's two tortillas per taco. So they dip it in a little bit of grease, they put it on the griddle, so it crisps just perfectly, so bring out all the masa flavors. And then after that, they start grilling whatever meat you might want to have. So Tacos El Chavito has about a dozen different types of meat. So you pick the meat, they cook it, they put it in there. If you want cilantro or onion, then you sprinkle that as well. And then on the side, also on the house, lemon or lime, of course, and also pickled radishes, jalapenos, carrots, and onions.
And of course, you have to go for all of that. That's what makes it brilliant.
The great thing about those taco truck tacos then, or especially El Chavito, is that you take a bite of the taco, you experience whatever meat you want. If it's chorizo, a little bit greasier, al pastor, much more tangier with citrus marinade. If you want carne asada, it's just, you know, those burnt nubs. You bite into that. And if you want to sprinkle salsa, they have a great salsa too, really thick and red. And the green one's a little bit lighter, but I like the red. And then after all that tanginess and the spice, you bite into the pickled radish, and it just gives this freshness that really the only other food that I know that gives that type of freshness is kimchi, Korean kimchi.
Yeah, that's true. And what it does, that freshness, it enables you to go on and consume yet another taco.
Yeah. So if you want to have your dinner, say, I'm hungry and I want to get three tacos, that's going to cost you $1.50. And with three tacos, honestly, that'll fill you up. You know, most men, if they want to get their grub on, then you could order, I would say,
six
tacos. That's $3 right there. And the best part, the free pineapple juice.
So free pineapple juice, fresh pineapple?
He makes it every day, and he only makes a set amount. So when it runs out, it runs out.
Because pineapple juice is famous for how quickly it ferments.
He keeps making it fresh. He keeps it on ice. It's probably usually out about by 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. So if you want the free pineapple juice, you have to get there really, really early. It's fresh, but you could still have some of the pineapple chunks in it. Just so wonderful. After it's done, though, sodas only cost you 50 cents.
So is it always parked in the same place?
It's always parked in the same street. It's in the industrial area of Huntington Beach, close to the Huntington Beach's barrio. It's on Morgan Street between Slater and Spear Avenues. So it parks right there, never moves, gets there around 7 in the morning, leaves around nighttime. They even have lights there just because it's busy the entire time. People walk in, people park their car, and then just leave.
So if you're going down to Huntington Beach to surf or to swim or to hang around for the day, if you don't live down there in the South Bay, it's definitely worth a trek.
You have to. two tacos for a buck.
Thank you so much, Gustavo. So give us a little wrap-up. Tell us what it's called and where it is.
The name of the place is Tacos El Chavito. It's a taco truck on Morgan Street between Slater and Spear Avenues in the city of Huntington Beach. No phone number because it's a taco truck.
Thank you, Gustavo.
Thanks, Evan.
Gustavo Arellano joins us from the OC Weekly. I've got the address and details about the place he mentioned at kcrw.com/goodfood. What are Americans most obsessed with? Fat? Well, it's got to be right up there. And I'm not even talking about the kind that's all over our thighs. I'm talking about the kind that makes food taste really delicious. I'll be back next on Good Food with a celebration of my favorite food group, fat. That's right here on KCRW and KCRW.com. It isn't often I receive a cookbook in the mail, look at the cover, and just immediately start laughing with sort of this laughter of joy and the knowledge that someone else out there is appreciating the offbeat things that I do. But when I saw a book called Fat, An Appreciation of a Misunderstood Ingredient, I thought, oh man, what is going to be between these pages must be quite interesting. The author is Jennifer McLagan, and we're with her today to celebrate the world of fat. So why do you think fat is such a misunderstood ingredient here?
I think it's had a lot of very bad press for probably the last 35 years. Everybody's been telling us how bad it is for us, how it's going to kill us. And every cookbook that you see is telling us how we can cut the fat out, or if we have to use fat, use any kind of fat except an animal fat. Animal fats have really had a lot of bad press.
When we give up fat, what are we giving up in terms of flavor?
Well, we're giving up flavor. That's what we're giving up, because the flavor is in the fat. And if you take all the fat away, it's pretty hard to tell what you're eating. And a lot of other flavors are transmitted in the fat. The fat carries them through in the dish. So it's not only important for the meat that we're eating, it's important when you're trying to add other flavors to the dish.
Now, I think the first fat that most of us think of is butter, and we think of people just, it's so funny, every once in a while when I'm cooking in my restaurant and I'll get stopped by a customer and they'll say, oh my gosh, that was incredible. Why does that taste so good? And I just look at them and I said, butter. Did you forget what it tastes like?
Well, you know, I think some of us have forgotten what it tastes like, because I don't know how it is where you are, but I'll go into my local supermarket and I probably have a choice of, I don't know, 50 different kinds of olive oil just in the supermarket. But I go over to where the butter's being sold, and there's hardly any choice at all. And the problem with butter, it's been shunted off because we thought it was so bad for us. And we've kind of forgotten how delicious it can taste, how it's a really seasonal product. Depending if it's spring butter or fall butter, it really has a different flavor. And then, like you say, you can't make a better sauce. You roast a bird or you pan fry a piece of veal and you take it out, you deglaze the pan, and then you just whisk in. It only has to be like a tablespoon of butter at the end, and you make a sauce that's delicious, looks good, and it's just so full of flavor.
And it has that, as I'm talking to you, my mouth is watering. It has that incredible mouthfeel that you can't get from anything except animal fat.
No, that's right, because animal fat has those big, round molecules. So when you put it into your mouth, it like coats your mouth and coats your tongue, and it gives you all those wonderful flavors. In fact, there is some people who are arguing that fat is the sixth taste. You know, we're always talking about salty and sour, sweet, bitter, umami, but maybe fat is the sixth taste. And of course, it's the French that are doing work in this area in the University of Bordeaux, and that's what they're claiming. And I tend to agree with them. Even if they're not right, I still want to believe that.
And me too. So is it difficult to make our own homemade butter?
No, it's amazingly simple, and I think it's something that everybody should do because it's just, it shows you how magical butter is. You have this one product, which is liquid cream. You take the best quality whipping cream you can buy, and you pour it into the bowl of your mixer. Let it warm up to room temperature first, and then you just whisk it. And it's like when you whip cream. We've all whipped cream and turned away or started talking on the telephone, and we go, oh, yikes, it's gone funny. Well, it hasn't really gone funny. It's turned into butter.
Okay, so let's turn from butter now to one of the other fats that might be a bit more complex. And one of the things that I find fascinating is that you talk about lamb fat, and I think that's a fat that people might be a little afraid of. So teach us.
I think the best thing with lamb fat is to render just a little bit of fat off the loin. If you buy loin chops like you see on the cover of the book, you're going to have lots of fat there you can render. And just try cooking lamb. If you like lamb, try cooking your lamb in fat. Instead of browning it in olive oil or browning it in something else, brown it in the fat. And you'll just get another layer of flavor. And another way I use it is to just, I make some chapatis or making a flatbread, just use a little bit of lamb fat to finish off something like that. And you'll find it really is quite delicious.
So you call pork fat the king. Why?
Mm-hmm. The king. I think there's a misunderstanding with pork fat because people think it's going to taste piggy. But actually, if you render pork fat correctly, it's very, very clean. It's very neutral in flavor. You can heat it very high. It's the easiest fat to get your hands on. And there's several different kinds of pork fat that are readily available. There's the back fat, which you see under the skin. And that can be rendered, and you can use that for frying in and cooking in. And then there's the leaf lard, as it's often called, and this is the fat from around the kidneys. And this fat, because it's inside the body, is harder, and it has a more crystalline structure. So it's the fat that you want to get if you want to make pastry. Unbelievable. It gives such flaky pastry. And then there's a fat that you can tell that I like, because it features in the end papers of the book, is coal fat. And this is the fat that's inside the body of the animal, keeping all its organs in place. And it's beautiful. I almost want to wear it out to like a dinner party or as a shawl somewhere because it looks like lace. And if you're making a terrine, you can line your pan with it instead of having to do bacon or something. You can wrap it around a patty, or if you want to make sausages and you don't want to put them into casings, you can use coal fat as the wrapping.
You are very brave. You're like a purveyor of a different kind of sin.
Yes, I want people to realize that it isn't a sin to eat fat. We've been eating fat for thousands and thousands of years, and we've just been fine. And it's only when we started thinking that animal fats were bad for us and we cut them out of our diet have we become sicker and fatter. You know, eating fat doesn't make you fat. You know, eating fat is actually really good for you. It's really satisfying. It's all about flavor and taste. That's why we eat, and why deny ourselves flavor and taste.
Fat, an appreciation of a misunderstood ingredient, is the name of Jennifer McLaughlin's latest cookbook. Find some recipes at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info on today's show, download and listen to it and other past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Please write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I do write back. Check out the Good Food blog there too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Stephen Billings. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Karen Soriano is the online editor. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.